You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, changes in the law over the past 8 years have made Wisconsin one of the least transparent states, according to some observers, when it comes to campaign finance. We'll talk with a journalist who talked to supporters and opponents of looser regulations and looked at how they have affected legislation. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Governor Walker took to Twitter yesterday to criticize NFL players who choose to kneel during the national anthem. An officer-involved shooting in Fox Crossing is getting some scrutiny after police released video of the encounter, and authorities have broken up an animal fighting ring in Pierce County, rescuing more than 1,500 birds and dogs. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks.
Well, let's start. It's an NFL opening weekend, and there's a Twitter war between Governor Walker and his opponents in the race for governor. What's going on?
So, Rob, on the one hand, we're talking about Twitter now, and this has nothing to do with any policy matter or anything that actually directly affects Wisconsinites. But by another way of looking at it, I think this little Twitter fight is actually one of the most telling things that's happened in this gubernatorial campaign. So essentially what happened was Governor Walker yesterday had a tweet storm, sustained criticism of NFL players who protest during the national anthem, who have taken a knee, and calling on Tony Evers, his Democratic opponent, to state his position. Does he stand up for the anthem? Does he think NFL players should be protesting during the national anthem, and criticizing the Democratic lieutenant governor candidate who has expressed support for the NFL players' protests?
Now, why do you say this is so telling?
Well, so as a friend of mine on Twitter said, is Walker chose to go full Trump here. This was not a dash off thing or a stray post. This was rolled out by the Walker campaign very much on purpose as a way to insert this issue into the race. You know, whatever you think about Walker, whether it's, you know, for those who support him or those who don't support him, he has tended to focus on real policy matters, like the policy changes that he and the Republican majority have implemented over the last year are significant and substantial, very different on a different poll in a different place than the kind of like symbolic culture war politics that that the president favors. And this was Walker jumping in with both feet into exactly that sort of politics.
Right. And President Trump has said pretty explicitly he thinks that the NFL issue, the players kneeling in protest of police brutality during the national anthem, President Trump thinks this is a winning issue for him. It looks like maybe at the Wisconsin level, Governor Walker and Republicans think it could be a helpful issue for them.
You know, maybe, yeah. I mean, I think there are a couple of possibilities here. One is that the Walker team thinks it's a winning issue, just in absolute terms, that more people will be on their side. I'm not really familiar enough with polling to judge that. I should say, before we go on, I should say Tony Evers did issue a response and said he's proud to stand for the national anthem and also, you know, respects the First Amendment rights of those who choose to protest during the anthem. So just so we don't just cruise past that. But on the politics, the other thing that could be going on here that is, I find, sort of a persuasive theory is that this is aimed directly at the Republican base. So to the extent that Republicans in Wisconsin are not so motivated, we've seen in special elections, Democrats have appeared to be much more motivated this year. In the Supreme Court election, that was the case. So this is a very Trumpy issue, and it's a sort of, you know, a very Fox News issue. And so this could be aimed at trying to juice the enthusiasm on that side of the aisle.
This could be two months now, Rob. It could be a long bunch of months here between now and Election Day.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, I mean, I I don't know. I don't want to sound like a nerd, but it is like, shouldn't we? It does feel like, aren't there more important topics, right? I mean, there's a lot of symbolic weight to this, and certainly it's like this is an issue that does resonate with people, for good or bad. People get very, very mad about this issue, but it's nothing to do with policy. Like, there are like actual policy matters at the state.
Let's move on to another story this week. A civil rights attorney is questioning the actions of a Fox Crossing police officer. This is in the Fox Cities area. After reviewing video of a shooting in May that led to the death of a 25-year-old man there. Can you tell us what happened, Rob, in that incident?
Right. So this is in late May. A police were called to the Trestle Trail Bridge in Fox Crossing after reports that a man with a knife was acting erratically and was threatening people with the knife. So when police were called in, they were aware that they were going into a potentially dangerous situation. They've released body camera footage, so we can see what happened. And a police officer approached this 25-year-old man, shouting at him to drop the weapon, to get down on the ground. The man did not obey those orders, and as he began to come toward the police officer, the officer shot him and killed him.
So what's the argument from a civil rights attorney now taking this up and criticizing the department here?
Well, the civil rights attorney's argument is that police did not do enough to de-escalate this situation. The man was in a public area. There were others in the vicinity, but there was no one else on the bridge, and so the argument is the man was somewhat contained. And what you did not see was police making an effort to de-escalate or to find an outcome besides a fatal outcome.
And what has the police department said about this?
Well, I mean, as a matter of law, this is actually somewhat cut and dry. The man was armed, and he was coming toward the police officer. You can see it in the video. So the Winnebago County District Attorney has concluded that that this was a justified shooting. There aren't going to be any charges against the officer. It's probably worth noting, just because of the context and many of these cases that become flashpoints, this was a young white man, and the officer also was white. As a legal matter, that's the fact that he had defied the orders and was coming toward the officer makes it justified. But there is a deeper question. Not every justified shooting necessarily needs to be a shooting. I don't know in this particular case. I'm not making an argument one way or another. But there is a conversation to be had about what tools are available to police and when they might choose to do something other than use force.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin about some of the top stories in Wisconsin news this last week. Moving west to Pierce County, another painful, difficult story here, Rob. Not too far from the Twin Cities, police uncovered a huge, they say, animal fighting operation. What did they find?
Yeah, Pierce County is in the sort of far western Wisconsin, almost like exurban Minneapolis. And they have seized 20 pit bulls and about 1,500 hens and roosters from this home, and they've found all the markers of animal fighting operations, the dog fighting and cock fighting operations with the ring, and the animals just kept in awful condition with scars and various signs of bad maltreatment.
And the police were originally there, I understand, because of drug charges or a suspicion of drugs on the premises.
Right. One of the people, the two people who lived in this home have been arrested and are in police custody. One of them had been previously arrested on drug charges, including police say they found a safe with 4 pounds of methamphetamine and this other earlier separate arrest. And at that time, when they were at the house, is when they discovered these all these animals and fighting facilities. And so this this seizure follows that.
And this is a big arrest. The scale of this historically seems pretty big, Rob.
Right, absolutely. I mean, there are we see there are very, you know, puppy mill cases. There are animal hoarding is a real thing, but these sort of underground fighting rings you don't see as often. There are in a case that National Public Radio reported on this case and referred to a massive operation in the Los Angeles area in recent years. But I mean, this has all the markers of a large underground operation. So it's a significant arrest.
Well, we'll watch that story as it moves through the courts. Want to wrap up on a happier and lighter note, Rob. The Milwaukee Brewers in a race for their division with the Chicago Cubs played a series this week at Miller Park in Milwaukee. On Tuesday, the Brewers won, pretty big, 11-1. And one fan marked that win in a pretty special and extravagant way. Can you talk about what happened?
So picture a giant 25-foot by 15-foot flag with blue flag with a giant white L on it, unfurled over the upper deck at Miller Park, reaching almost down to like the outfield wall. It was hilarious.
As a giant L, and this is something that I guess the Cubs do at their home field, put up the W or L if they win or lose. This was a particular message. Now, I don't know where I would go to buy a 25 by 15 blue flag with a big L on it. It sounds like this had to be made custom.
Well, yeah, I'm proud to say that my colleagues at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel got to the bottom of this. This is a DeForest man named Jay Ryan, and it was custom made. He ordered it for $140 online, so that he could have the opportunity to troll Cubs fans. By the way, I'm a Cubs fan. I should come clean.
What?
I grew up in Central Illinois. My family, it's Cubs people. What can I say? But I have to give points. This is quality trolling.
I'm looking at the judges. Okay, we're going to allow that, Rob. Your Cubs fandom. So you're hoping to not see this L flag too many times in the future.
That's right. Well, I mean the Cubs are still in first place, but the Brewers have another crack at next week. There's a new series, so the L flag, Brewers fans, you may have another opportunity.
Well, another good talk, Rob. I'm waving a giant W flag for you. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's with us for our weekly roundup of news from around the state. In the interest of accuracy, I do not, in fact, have a giant W flag that I'm waving in the studio. Since the U.S. Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision ruled that political spending from corporations and nonprofit groups was a form of protected free speech, Wisconsin has enacted major changes to campaign finance laws. Those looser regulations have led some observers to call Wisconsin one of the least transparent states when it comes to money and politics. But does that mean corporations have more of an influence on what laws actually get passed? Our next guest looked back at the last 8 years and changes to the 2013 state budget involving lead paint manufacturers to find out. Poen Nadeau recently wrote about this for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Poen, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Great to be here.
Well, you've got this lead paint story, but it's a bigger story, too. You're kind of picking apart how campaign money works, sometimes invisibly, here in Wisconsin. What did you set out to find out in this piece?
Well, basically what I set out to find out is how did the campaign finance laws in Wisconsin change post Citizens United? And if it has changed drastically because of those changes, is Wisconsin less Democratic because of that? And we started off with Citizens United, and then we went on to see the investigation into Governor Walker's, that John Doe investigation. And we saw that the Wisconsin Supreme Court kind of sided with the governor, and from the experts I talked to, they basically said it kind of retroactively kind of okayed coordination between candidates and independent expenditures here in Wisconsin, and we also looked at the 2015 change in campaign finance laws.
With that change along coordination, you write that that makes Wisconsin not completely unique, but it's rare in the United States that there are laws and court rulings allowing coordination between a politician's campaign and these outside groups, right?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I talked to a man at the Brand Center for Justice at NYU. His name was Daniel Weiner. And he actually said Wisconsin and Florida are the only two states that kind of allow this sort of coordination. Wisconsin specifically, it's because of Supreme Court decisions, mostly stemming back from 2015.
Let's dig into this lead paint change that used as a case study. Give us some background into what was at stake here.
Sure. Well, I did mention one individual. Her name was Yasmin Clark in 2000. When she was 2 years old, she was actually lead poisoned and hospitalized because of that. And when she was 5 years old, she was also lead poisoned again. So she was part of a class action suit that totaled over 170 different children, and they brought that to the circuit courts in Milwaukee itself. And while these cases were being processed and whatnot, I believe it was back in 2013 this happened. There was a change in the law. It changed in a specific law, and I obtained a memo that said National Lead, which was actually one of the paint manufacturers that was being sued, decided to actually send Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald an email asking them to basically rewrite the law to basically dismiss those 170 cases. But in the future, the cases were still brought up to the circuit courts, and there was a circuit court judge, I forget his name right now, that basically said that change to the law was unconstitutional.
And at issue, as I understand, this lead story is a little complicated, but the idea is, can you sue lead paint manufacturers in general, even if you don't know that this person was poisoned by this person's paint? And then that second, so the law said, no, you can't, and that second change was to say, make it retroactive, in effect, right?
Yes. That's basically what happened, yes.
And now, on the money side of things, you mentioned this company, NL, National Lead, it stands for,
yes.
Right? They had also made donations in kind of Wisconsin's new landscape of campaign finance.
Definitely. It was actually the former founder of National Lead, he's passed away now, Harold Simmons. He made two donations to Governor Walker's campaign totaling of $750,000.
Now, looking at campaign finance laws in general, how easy is it usually to track who donated what and what issues they might have at stake?
It depends on what you're looking for. I mean, if a person is donating directly to a candidate, it's not too hard to find it. I mean, all that is necessarily public record. But when we come to issue ad groups and independent expenditures, it becomes a little bit more difficult. I don't believe that a person necessarily has to give their name or their employer. All they necessarily have to list is their occupation. So, like, all the documents I was in the article itself of all the people I named, it was actually all of that stemmed from the Guardian leaked articles and back in a couple years ago.
Now, you talk to people who are advocates for campaign finance reform. How do they say this hurts people in Wisconsin if there's all this money in politics and you can't always trace it?
Definitely. And then, the one thing that a lot of people said is that the candidates, the politicians, and the legislators, they don't necessarily do what they used to do and go around, do town halls, go around their district and their constituents and talk to them as much. They're mostly focusing on getting those large-scale donations. And from the people I talked to, they said they talked to people from all across the state, and they said, my representative or my senator doesn't come here anymore.
You also talked to someone who is happy with the changes, Mike Wittenweiler,
yes.
An attorney who's
yes.
advocated for looser campaign finance laws. What was the case he made?
Well, he basically made the case that we need to have the broadest free speech laws as we possibly could. He said, no corporation, unions, even media members should should be kind of forced by arbitrary decisions on what they can and cannot say, how they can and cannot use their money.
And then back on the other side, you write, there are efforts in the state and beyond to try to tighten up campaign finance laws. Can you talk about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, definitely. Maybe the most intense campaign, it comes from, I forget the name of the organization really quick.
The United to Amend group, I think you wrote about?
United to Amend. Yeah, they're actually going around a lot of villages, a lot of jurisdictions in the state, and they're actually advocating for amendment to the United States Constitution. I'm quoting them right now. They want to have an amendment that says money is not speech and corporations is not people. They did over 100 votes in different jurisdictions here in Wisconsin, and they haven't lost a vote yet.
We'll leave it there for now. Poen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Poen Nadeau is a journalist whose recent piece with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looked into changes in campaign finance laws here in the state and their impact, potential impact on legislation. You can read more at wisconsinwatch.org. Homeland Security Director Kirstjen Nielsen said this week that the risk from cyber threats to the United States is now greater than the risk of physical attack. She made the comments this Wednesday at George Washington University.
DHS was founded 15 years ago to prevent another 9/11, but I believe an attack of that magnitude is much more likely to reach us online than on an airplane. As we speak, the bad guys are in our networks checking for open windows or doors, and everyone and everything is a target.
Her statements came after recent reports of hacking attempts into American electrical infrastructure and with lingering concerns over the security of voting systems after Russian hacking attempts in the 2016 presidential election. Scott Borg is the director and chief economist at the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit, a nonprofit organization that researches cybersecurity issues. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for the attention you're giving to this critically important subject.
Well, we heard Homeland Security Director Kirstjen Nielsen there. Is she overstating the case, or is this something on the scale of a 9/11 style cyber attack that we should be worried about?
She's not overstating the case. In fact, Kirstjen Nielsen has been very interested in this subject for a long time, and she actually knows what she's talking about here. A cyber attack that was sufficiently sophisticated and seriously destructive would be exceeded in damage only by a nuclear attack.
Spell that out for us, because I think a lot of people might think of a cyber attack as kind of an abstract thing, not something that's going to directly affect our daily lives. How could it manifest itself in such a serious way?
So pretty much everything these days is run by computers. If you think of any industry that we depend on all the time, like electricity or oil and gas or banking or even railroad, it's all run by computers. A cyber attack, a really sophisticated cyber attack, would be like putting an enemy agent in charge of the computers that run all those things. Imagine the damage you could do if you could control all the railroad switches and signals, if you could direct the trains at any speed you wanted to crash into each other, if you could arrange the crashes to take place on tunnels and on bridges and into other critical facilities. Imagine the damage you could do if you could control all the pressures and temperatures at an oil refinery. Pretty much all of these critical infrastructures could be physically destroyed by cyber attacks.
Now, we've heard lately a lot about the Internet of Things, where a lot of our, say, appliances are cyber-connected, and criticism saying that, okay, they've had almost no security elements put into them at all. Is the same thing true of those key infrastructure points you've been talking about, where we connected them, we computerized them, and we didn't pay enough attention to security on the way to doing that?
So actually, the cybersecurity of our critical industries is pretty good. Otherwise, horrible things like the kind I just described would have already taken place. The problem is, we are staying ahead of the attackers, but the margin here isn't all that great. If the attackers suddenly have a surge in creativity and increase their capabilities, or if the capabilities that are currently held by Russia and China and major nation states spread to terrorist organizations, suddenly that safety margin disappears altogether and we become just enormously vulnerable.
Talking to Scott Borg from the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit about cybersecurity, the risk of attacks here in the United States. And let's get to this idea. We've heard it from Homeland Security now, and General David Petraeus just wrote an op-ed, co-wrote an op-ed saying we need a full-scale cyber force, if you will, a cybersecurity unit, independent, that's really tackling these issues head-on. What do you think of that?
So we have a military cyber force already. The proposal is to have a separate agency focused on cybersecurity. In principle, that's a very good idea. In fact, in principle, I think that should be a cabinet-level job, and that should be an entirely separate major department of government. In practice, I'm not sure if this is such a good idea because there's so little understanding on the part of politicians and senior people in Washington. So little understanding of cyber attacks.
Can you spell out for us what we have now when it comes to federal cybersecurity efforts?
What we have now are cyber forces and cybersecurity activities spread across a whole bunch of different government departments. There's a major cyber activity in the Pentagon, in the intelligence agencies, in the Department of Homeland Security. Now, that's not itself a bad thing because there are many different government missions where cybersecurity is concerned. The government needs to be able to defend our critical infrastructure industries from cyber attacks or at least help with that. The government needs to be able to prosecute cybercrime, assemble evidence, and make legal cases against cyber criminals. The government needs to be able to develop cyber offensive capabilities. The government needs, and so on. So there's a whole series of things. If one government agency has the responsibility for many of those things, they're going to be in conflict with each other. All of those things I just mentioned are actually conflicting missions. So one of the problems with implementing a single agency, with having a single agency be in charge, is that agency is going to have a very good way of setting priorities, or it will be sacrificing a lot of critical government missions in order to carry out others.
Now, part of the reason we have a Department of Homeland Security was that after 9/11, there was the idea that we had all these different intelligence and law enforcement agencies that didn't necessarily communicate well with each other. That's one of the things that made us, people said, more vulnerable to attack. Are we in 2018 in that position with cybersecurity now? Whether it may be perfectly valid to have these separate agencies, maybe they're not playing that well together.
It's sort of a mixed report card for that. There are a lot of areas where those different parts of government are actually sharing information quite well right now. The intelligence, different intelligence agencies, and the military are actually doing a pretty good job of sharing information. But in general, it's chaos. When you get down to a lower level, when you get down to all these activities involving cybersecurity scattered all over the place, there's no real order to any of it. Now, again, that's not entirely a bad thing because there are so many different missions that need to be carried out.
One consistent theme I keep reading about from people who seem to be focused on this issue is we have a talent problem, a recruitment problem. It's hard to bring people into government with these in-demand cybersecurity skills. Is that something you're seeing?
Yes, yes. Periodically, I attend meetings about what are we going to do about this? How are we going to improve our cybersecurity training? And also, how are we going to educate the general public better about cybersecurity? One of the big stumbling blocks here is that most politicians don't really know much about cybersecurity or information technology. An ordinary citizen comes home from work and they check their email if they haven't already checked it on their smartphone on the way home. They stream videos. They web surf for different things. They manage their photographs. They know what a JPEG is. They manage their music. They know what an MP3 is. Politicians generally don't know what a JPEG or an MP3 is. Politicians generally don't even do their own email. They don't understand this subject as much as the general public. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so delighted to be talking on this program, is we really need people who are using this technology all the time to drive things forward, because the politicians are mostly not up to it.
What do you want to see when it comes to educating, I guess, politicians in some of the basic elements of cybersecurity issues?
There are two really huge misunderstandings involving cyber attacks that I run into all the time. One of them is that people don't appreciate, and especially politicians, don't appreciate the full range of cyber attacks. They think that a cyber attack is whatever has just recently made the news. So some years ago, people thought a cyber attack was a mass disruption virus shutting down lots of servers. Now they seem to think a cyber attack is stealing personal account information. They use the word breach, and cyber attack is those words as though they're synonymous. They're forgetting that any time you're manipulating information systems, any time you're interfering with the proper functioning of those systems, that's a cyber attack. So that means if you're falsifying IP addresses, if you're making it look like communications are coming from different sources than they are, that's a cyber attack. If you're putting up false identities all over the place and often running them by bots, by automated networks of computers you've taken over, that's a cyber attack. The Russians and the Chinese understand this. They're mounting coordinated cyber campaigns that are manipulating our media, manipulating global information flows, and coordinating that with criminal cyber attacks all at once. America's mostly functioning like a blind man here, or like someone with tunnel vision. We're not really seeing what's going on because we're thinking of cyber attacks so narrowly.
We're talking to Scott Borg of the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit about the cyber threats facing the U.S. There are lots of them, and how well we're doing to safeguard against them. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and thoughts. Are you worried about this array of cyber attacks from hackers or foreign adversaries? Are they on your radar? Do you think the federal government should make it more of a priority? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Scott Borg of the group U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit, talking about cybersecurity and the threats we face. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we as a country, our government, are taking these issues seriously enough? Do you work in cybersecurity? What are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. Scott, before we go to our callers, I was maybe going to ask you about, you know, the magic solution, the flow chart change that we need, the one investment we need. It sounds like you're saying we need a culture change in our government and society at large.
Yes, we do. Cyber attacks, cybersecurity is an issue now that will be all over the place for the foreseeable future.
Let's go to our callers. Joel is on the line in Milwaukee. Joel, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just wanted to share that I'm a computer science major at UW-Milwaukee, and I've spoken with about maybe 9 or 10 other computer science majors, and I think I'm the only one of us heading into anything to do with cybersecurity, which is kind of haunting, I guess. It doesn't seem like I was just kind of agreeing with your idea that there is a staffing problem.
Joel, thanks a lot for giving us that firsthand experience there. Do you see this, Scott, across the country? People are going into, sure, a computer science field, cybersecurity not necessarily on the radar, government work less so?
That's true. And people who get degrees in computer science often have never had a course in cybersecurity. They don't know about secure coding. They don't know how to produce software that has basic security features. So this is a real crisis. One of the things that would help is if we could just get the word out how much you're paid if you have a solid degree in computer science and a specialty in cybersecurity and just a little bit of experience, maybe just summer intern experience. Your starting salary is extraordinarily high.
Joel, thanks for the call. Good luck to you. We'll go to Randy now in Friendship. Randy, hi.
Hi, I was just, maybe my question was answered. I was wondering where they recruit people to prevent these cyber attacks. Do they do it through military personnel or like schools like MIT, or I had heard about computer science, and I was just interested in, you know, how they recruit or how people would even get into the field to work in that field.
Randy, thanks.
They do it any which way they can. Increasingly, the pathway into the field is to get a degree in computer science and do some kind of specialization in cybersecurity. But historically, people have come into the field from all kinds of different directions. Some of the leading cybersecurity experts in America, some of the best-known names in the field, are able to be leading experts and work for and with the government simply because they were under 18 when they were caught hacking into things.
Thanks a lot for that call. But does it come to a point now, I have that cybersecurity degree, I'm maybe going to make a lot more working for Silicon Valley than I am for Washington, D.C.?
The need for cybersecurity is not primarily in Washington, D.C. The real need for cybersecurity is in the electrical industry, in the banking and financial services industry, out there in the companies running the pipelines and refineries. It's out there in the critical infrastructure industries. That's the front line. That's where cybersecurity is most urgently needed, not in Washington.
I wanted to ask before we wrap up what you mentioned. There's a huge range of cybersecurity concerns out there. 2018, last half of the year, what are you worried about most right now?
I'm most worried about the way the Russians and the Chinese are coordinating cyber attacks at a level that America is mostly oblivious to. Let me give an example. Russian organized cybercrime is able to survive without being prosecuted or extradited because they keep the Russian government happy. One of the ways they do this is by coordinating their criminal cyber attacks with Russian foreign policy. So even if an attack is an attempt to steal money, a criminal theft using computers, if it's coming out of Russia or China or actually a number of other countries, it's part of a national agenda. America isn't even recognizing that this is going on. Nobody's talking about it.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us and taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Really appreciate the attention of this subject. We need it so much right now.
We've been talking to Scott Borg, Director and Chief Economist with the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit, a nonprofit cybersecurity research group. He joined us to look at cyber threats facing the United States, what the nation is doing, and industries, too, to protect against them.